Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Women's Soccer Zone. Delighted to have you with us. I'm actually flying solo on this edition of Women's Soccer Zone. My friend JJ Duke unable to join me on this edition. So I'm not going to talk too much myself because the last thing we want is for me to be chatting on my own. But quickly going to rattle off what we've got on this show. I was fortunate enough last week to attend a pretty high-profile friendly between Manchester City Women and FC Rosengard in Manchester. And while I was there, managed to have a quick chat with Man City's new Swedish striker, Kosovare Asllani, who, of course, has been on the show previously. And another previous guest who I managed to catch up with very quickly while she was in the country was Anita Asante. Managed to have a quick chat about how she's getting on in Sweden and, obviously, how she feels at the moment, not being involved in the current England setup. Managed to have a chat with our friends down in Australia, the Women's Game, and their founder and editor, Anne O'Dong, about the W League Grand Final that was won by Melbourne City Women about a week and a half ago on the day that I'm recording this. So we had a chat about that and had a little look back at the W League season as a whole. And finally, I managed to catch up with someone I can now call a colleague, having just joined the Equaliser Soccer website. Managed to have a chat with Jen Gordon, one of the writers there, about the current situation between US soccer and the US Women's National Team Union and the dispute over the CBA that currently exists. So without further ado, after a very short break, we'll come back and talk about Man City and Rosengard.
Women's Soccer Zone. Follow the show on Twitter at WOSOZone.
So welcome back. As I mentioned in the intro, I was in Manchester last week to watch Man City Women against FC Rosengard. Managed to catch the game just a few days after the FAWSL fixtures were announced. And the games will kick off on Wednesday, the 23rd of March. And City themselves will host Notts County Ladies. Liverpool Ladies will host Birmingham City. Arsenal Ladies will host newly promoted Reading. And the following day, on Thursday, the 24th of March, Doncaster Rovers Bells will host champions Chelsea Ladies. And then we go into the weekend before Sunderland Ladies have their first game hosting Reading. Well, it gave me an opportunity after those fixtures to check out one of the favourites for the league, as already mentioned, Manchester City. And they had a 3-1 victory over Swedish champions FC Rosengard. Looked very, very impressive in that match. Izzy Christensen, the England international, particularly looked very, very good. But I managed to catch up after the game with their new Swedish striker, Kosovare Asllani, who, of course, joined in January, made a lot of headlines over here when she joined the club. So here she is having a quick chat with me about her move to Manchester City and how she's settling into life in the northwest of England. Delighted to be joined by Kosovare Asllani. Koso, you've just come off the pitch after making your debut for Manchester City Women against Rosengard. First of all, how did you find the game and how much did you enjoy making your first appearance?
It was fun. It was fun playing today. I mean, it's the first game for me and for the team for this year, so I think we did real well. I mean, I like how the team plays. I like the way we think and what we want with our football. So I'm 100% sure that I will enjoy my football this year.
And ironically, debut against Swedish opposition, some of your Swedish national team teammates there. How much do you enjoy coming up against them?
Yeah, I met up with them yesterday, so we were talking a little bit, and it was, like you say, it's a little bit typical that I play a game against a Swedish team as my first game. So, but I mean, it was good opposition, and I mean, it was a very good start for us.
And talking about the move, you've come over from PSG. What's been your initial first impressions? I know you have not been here for very long, but how have you found it so far?
I mean, I've only been here for a week and already played the game, so I've only had good impression by the club, the facility, the girls and the team. I mean, I only have good things to say. But now, like, we need to keep on improving and we need to keep on working on the details, because it's the details that are the difference if we want to win. So I hope and I know that we will have the time before the season starts to work on that.
Some of your Swedish teammates for the national team are over here in England. Hedvig Lindahl's at Chelsea. Sofia Jakobsen played for Chelsea. Did you speak to any of them before you decided to come over?
I didn't speak that much. I talked a little bit with Hedvig, just asking her because I didn't want to kind of letting her know that I'm before making decisions. So I just asked her a little bit what she thinks about the league and how it is, you know, because it's hard for me. Like, I played in the US, I played in France and Sweden, but in England, like, I was curious, and that was the most important thing. That, like, I've seen the English national team, like, they've been doing really well, and seeing what I see in training, I mean, we have quality players, so I think this league has a high level.
Do you feel any pressure coming into this league? It's your move when it was announced was a big deal. You're looked at as quite of a marquee, a big signing, not just for Manchester City, but for the league as well. We're starting to see more players come in from overseas. Do you feel any pressure coming into the league because you're such a big name and because people see it as such a big move?
No, I don't feel pressure. I wouldn't call it like that. I mean, I was curious about the league. I was curious about this team, seeing the facilities and everything. I mean, I don't feel like pressure. Right now, I've only been here for a week, and I need to keep on working on my... Like, I'm not 100% fit right now, so I need to work on that. So I think it could be a really fun year.
When you joined the club, I read the club's website, you said this feels like the future. What did you mean when you said that?
I feel like when I came to the facility, like I've been in different clubs, like the last club, PSG, and it's a lot of teams that says that they want to be like, they want to be the best in the world and this and that. But when I came here, like I never seen this kind of a facility. Like, the facility, it's world class. People that works here, it's world class. I mean, if you want to get better as a player, if you want to have everything that the tools to get better as a player, this is the right place. That's what I felt from the beginning. Like, I was it's like the men's, like, that's why I said it feels like the future for the women. Like, a lot of teams talks about that they want to have so much and they want to invest so much in women's football, but here they really have done it, so it's not only words.
You've played in Sweden, you've played in the United States, you've played in France. When you went to PSG, it was kind of a similar situation where it was a club looking to build, looking to try and compete with Lyon. Always fell a little bit short, but do you feel that there is comparisons to what Manchester City are trying to achieve here, and do you think you can achieve your ambitions here as well?
That's what how I feel. Like, when I went to PSG, that was the first year they started to invest in women's football. Here it feels like, okay, they're already invested because they have amazing players, quality players already. But now, like, it feels like it was the right move for me, and I just can't wait until the season starts because I like what I saw today.
Now, I don't want to take up any more of your time, so one last question. I saw Pierre Sundhage was here watching the game today. Now, I know that you haven't been involved in the Sweden team more recently. How much of an ambition is it to do well here so that you can get yourself back into that Sweden side?
I'm not thinking about it, that at all. For me, it's just about getting into this team, playing well as this team, win with this team. Like, I'm here to play good football, improve as a player. So I'm not thinking about it, everything at the side. I'm just focusing on my club right now.
So that was Kosovari Aslani. As mentioned in the intro, of course, on the opposition side was Anita Asante, having had a number of caps for England. She's not currently in the England setup under Mark Sampson. So I want to have a quick chat with her, see how things are going on at FC Rosengard, and of course, not being currently in the setup for England. So here she is.
Finally joined by Anita Asante on Women's Soccer Zone. Delighted, having been on a few times prior. Anita, you just come off the pitch. Tough game against Man City. How'd you find it?
Yeah, I think they did a really good job today. You know, they really put a lot of pressure on us and tried to stress us a bit in our possession play. And yeah, I think they worked really hard and well together defensively and offensively and had a lot of success.
You have a big Champions League quarter-final on the horizon. How much are you looking forward to that one? Big game coming up.
Yeah, I mean, I'm excited for the game. I think it's, again, another tough challenge for us, and we hope, you know, when the occasion arises, we'll be really, you know, thoroughly ready to go and, you know, understand our game plan and exactly how to exploit their weaknesses. But today was a good test for us because, you know, we were facing an unknown opposition. We didn't really know what to expect. We didn't really know their style of play or where their strengths or weaknesses were. So it was more about how we could support each other as a team in, on the field. But it's nice to see also, you know, an English club playing a good style of football and that English football is developing.
You're going into your fifth year in Sweden now. I was looking at it on a few pages. Obviously, you had your time at Göteborg and over here at Rosengård, formerly Malmo. How much are you enjoying it out in Sweden? The league is, you won the league title last year.
Yeah.
From an outsider looking in, it doesn't look as competitive as maybe it has been in previous years. Tiraspol obviously folded, Göteborg, players have drifted from into your team and to other teams across Europe.
Yeah.
How are you finding it yourself being in that league and being in that team?
Well, I mean, yeah, I guess from the outside it would seem that way because we, you know, we did have world-class teams like Tiraspol the previous years, and they were obviously a really tough competitors for our club too. But we actually, you know, we had to fight till the last game of the season last year to win the title. So for us, it was very much competitive, and we had a lot at stake. So, you know, I think we still have a great number of internationals on both on our club and within the league. I think that in itself probably is representative of how competitive it is, or you know, at least for the level that players wish to play at. And you know, we're a team that have consistently at the minute been getting into Champions League and striving for reaching in the finalist positions. And for me, that's a good reflection of where we want to go.
Wasn't a criticism, I can assure you.
No, it's okay, it's fine.
But you look at you've come up against Man City today. You've seen from afar the investment and the profile of the English league rising. Ever a temptation to come back sometime?
Well, I never say never. I don't know if I could play at Man City. I'm a Liverpool fan, so that'd be quite treacherous, I think. But a nice, amazing facilities they have here. I think it's great for women's football that they get the same access to great training facilities and match fields, and hopefully that can continue to progress.
And then I have to ask, obviously the England team did very well at the World Cup last year. I'm sure you still have many an ambition to be part of that team. Any contact with Mark Sampson? Have you managed to speak to him? Is there still a chance for you to be in that squad that you're aware of?
Well, I haven't had any contact with him since the last call-up that I had early last year and post-World Cup either. And of course, as any player wishes to play at the highest level and the biggest platforms, and that ambition has never changed for me. I want to play at the highest level right now. I think I'm still good enough to do that, and really, you know, football's subjective, so it's up to the coach at the end of the day, and I have to respect that. But you know, if he was to give me a call, of course I would jump at the chance to listen and see if I have an opportunity in the future.
Women's Soccer Zone would like to thank our partners, She Kicks Magazine. Subscribe at shekicks.net for even more women's football.
So that was Anita Asante. Big thanks to her and wish her well. And from a personal perspective, hope we see her back in the England fold sooner rather than later. One of the most calm and composed players that I've had the pleasure of watching in the time that I've been following women's football. Well, that will wrap up this segment of the show. And when we come back, we will talk to Anne O'Dong from the women's game about the W League final.
Women's Soccer Zone. It's all about the players.
So once again, for this episode of Women's Soccer Zone, I am privileged and delighted to be joined by my good friend Anne O'Dong. People who listened to our preview of the grand final between Melbourne City and Sydney FC will have heard her last week. Anne, how the devil are you?
I'm pretty good. It's been a couple of days since the grand final, and it's now starting to settle in that the season is actually over.
And what a shame it's over. It's one of those leagues, the W League, where it's almost over before it's even begun. I'm going to assume that, you know, there is a little bit of a somber mood about that, but nonetheless, a very, very competitive and enjoyable league once again. We'll talk about the league as a whole shortly, but I did want to have a little bit of a chat about the grand final that took place the other week between Melbourne City FC and Sydney FC. It was
A 4-1 win for Melbourne. Now, you were there. Was the scoreline a reflection of the game? Did Melbourne dominate as much as a 4-1 reflection would suggest? Or was it closer than the scoreline would perceive?
Look, it was one of those games that as the match progressed, you could see that the team that was the more powerful team, the more dominant team, would work their ways to be on top. And that's pretty much what happened. And 4-1 definitely was not indicative of the play on the day. In particular, that last goal was basically the last kick of the game, with Lisa Devanna scoring a much-deserved goal for all the hard work that she'd done. Sydney FC, actually, you have to applaud them. They could have easily come out and tried to sit, and they probably would have been able to do so. They'd been really good defensively the last couple of weeks, and they could have done that, and it would have been probably a boring, negated final 1-0 to Melbourne City as they tried to work their way through the Sydney defence. But props to Dan Barrett and to his team. They went out and they went at Melbourne City. They tried to go out and win the final, which is what you hope teams would do on the biggest stage. They had their chances, but they just couldn't convert them. And that's been their problem all season, is that they've struggled to score. And against a team like Melbourne City, who has such a solid defence, it's going to come back and bite you if you don't take advantage of the chances that you do create early on in the game.
Melbourne City undoubtedly went into that game as favourites. They hadn't lost all season, other than Brisbane Roar taking them to a penalty shootout in the semi-final of the playoffs. They'd won every game prior to that in 90 minutes. With that in mind, do you feel that maybe experience came into play on this occasion? The likes of, we've seen the scorers, Jen Beattie, Kim Little, Lisa Devanna, players like Jess Fishlock, Steph Catley in that team. Was it experience that in the end ran out winners? We know that Sydney themselves have some experienced players. Kaya Simon was, of course, on the score sheet for them. But big games require big players, and Melbourne City have plenty of them in their squad, don't they?
They do, and while you would say experience is important, I think what happened more was just the quality rose to the top. If you have a look across the pitch, player by player, Melbourne City, and position by position, Melbourne City probably just had the edge. We did a pre-match analysis where we went through the goalkeepers, the defence, the midfielders and the forwards, and pretty much in each one, the edge was just to Melbourne City. And that's what told on the day, is that when it came to 50-50 balls, when it came to taking advantage of those balls in behind the defence or getting in on top in the midfield, City just had that little bit more. And I think what it eventually told out, as I said, was quality probably more than experience.
What's been the response to Melbourne City's win? Obviously, they're a new team. It was their first season in the W League. Some not necessarily welcoming of that, probably those that are in Melbourne and were Melbourne Victory supporters, but others who welcomed it, the way that they've approached the league, the way that they've tried to bring in high-quality players that you've already mentioned, that we've spoken about in the past. What's been the response since they won that grand final?
The response to Melbourne City's win has been a little bit mixed. I think early on in the season, there was a lot of criticism about how the team came about and how quickly it was formed, and also just the fact that they could have probably gone to a full home and away season before they added the expenditure of an extra team. But as you get towards the end of the season, there was an understanding that they've actually raised the level and are now asking questions of the other clubs. How much more are you prepared to spend on your teams? I think in the past, teams have been able to skirt with doing almost the minimum or just a little bit above the minimum. But with Melbourne City in their first season, putting real expenditure in their team, real investment, a lot of clubs, W League clubs, are now being asked, how much do you care about your W League teams and how much more are you prepared to do?
One of the things I wanted to ask was, we mentioned it off recording before we came onto the show, the impact that Melbourne City have maybe had on Melbourne Victory. We've seen only a few years ago Melbourne Victory win the grand final under Dave Edmondson, and some of those players that won the league with Melbourne City last week were in that Melbourne Victory team. The likes of Jess Fishlock, Steph Catley, Beattie Goad, Lisa Devanna, all involved in that Victory team, all have left that side and moved on to Melbourne City. Now,
I'm not going to be critical because, as we've already discussed, you know, Melbourne City have brought a lot of positives to the league. They are raising the standards. It's for everyone else now to decide how they want to match that. But the impact on Melbourne victory, that's been significant, hasn't it?
It has, but part of it has been victory's own making. They were so late to the party, and we saw the handover from Football Federation Victoria, which is the state federation, across to the Victory Club itself. Because of that, there was so much uncertainty for these players. A lot of these players actually wanted to stay with Victory. But, you know, things were not going answered. They would ask questions, they wouldn't be answered. And by the time that they wanted some certainty, because a lot of those players are preparing for an Olympics campaign, they just wanted to have that locked in and ready to go. Meanwhile, Melbourne City, they had their program, they had their coach, they had their facilities locked down, they had all of that ready to go. So by the time those players were tapped on the shoulder, everything was in place, and that was where the problem was. I think Victory was not so much about Melbourne City coming in and raiding, which they kind of did, to be fair, but it was also that Victory were just not ready. They didn't have a coach until almost 2 weeks before the season started, and you can't act like that. You can't have that going on. And for a professional player, a player who does want to further their career, they're just not going to take that. They're going to go for the team that is ready and willing.
And that comes back to what you were saying earlier about Melbourne City setting the standards, and Melbourne Victory certainly now have a job on their hands to try and match their City counterparts. But going away from the grand final, going away from the impact of Melbourne City, W League has, as we've already said, sadly come to an end for another year. Compare it to other seasons. Compare it to other leagues around the world. It's still very much in its infancy. But when you look at the impact of the W League and the season as a whole, how would you evaluate it?
To be fair, I think the standard was down this year, and that is the City effect. When you have 20 new players coming into a league, it means that the other teams kind of get shifted. And particularly because City did take a lot of the cream of the crop from other clubs, and that meant that those clubs then had to find replacement players, and a lot of those replacement players were teenagers. I think when you look at the W League, you have to kind of think about what is the rationale and what is the mission of the league, and that mission is about development. And we did see a lot of good development in some good players this season. We saw Ali Carpenter, who's a 15, 16-year-old who has basically forced her way into Matilda's camp from her play this year. So that's a positive for the league. You've got the likes of also Princess Abini, who played in the grand final, and some really good young players also from Adelaide coming through. So if you look at it, the rationale of the league, it is doing its job, and we did have some good players come through. But in terms of the standard, I think we need to work on that. We need to work on getting it to a stage where there is consistency. And I thought last season we had done that. And while it was quite even behind Melbourne City, but that also spoke to the fact that they were so far ahead that everybody else was kind of bunched together.
I was, as listeners will know, was in Baltimore recently for the NSCAA convention, and the NWSL commissioner, Jeff Plush, was there, and media had an opportunity to talk to him. And one of the questions came up was the relationship that exists between the NWSL and the W League. Obviously, we see a number of Australian players join the American League, and we've seen in the W League, I would say especially this year, a number of players joining from the NWSL. Now, you've talked about development in the league and a lot of young Australian players. What's the view of Australians of the influx of players from the NWSL? Is it helping to develop those young Australian players because they are playing with higher quality individuals, or is it detrimental because young players that maybe should and would be getting a game aren't because players are coming in from another country?
No, it's definitely been a beneficial impact to have those players in. I think for people to understand, for example, we had Megan Oyster and Caprice Didasco at the Newcastle Jets. They were really good for the Jets, but they're only first-year, second-year NWSL players. But in comparison to the 16, 17-year-olds that they've got on their team, they're actually quite experienced with 4 years of college behind them, playing youth national teams and also playing representative national teams as well. That's a level that those young players haven't seen yet. So it's a twofold development for the NWSL players and for the W League players. For the NWSL players, they're suddenly having to be leaders within their team. And we saw that with Didasco and Oyster in particular. They did that so well. So it's a twofold development, and I think it helps both the NWSL and also the W League. And ideally, you'd like to see that relationship formalised and cemented.
Who are the players that came over from America that really impressed you?
I have to say Oyster and Didasco were fantastic for the Newcastle Jets. I think Kendall Fletcher has been a very good player for a long time, and also quite impressed with Hayley Kottmeyer as the goalkeeper for Brisbane Roar. She was phenomenal for the Roar on many occasions this season. So I think with them, it allows some of those players to actually get game time that they don't get in the NWSL, because they are considered, you know, the debutants and the new kids on the block. While in the W League, they're starting players. And Didasco said herself, it was just nice for her for 14 weeks just to get 90 minutes week in and week out.
And you even saw experienced players. We're talking about youngsters who saw it as an opportunity. Vanessa DiBernardo was another one who I know made a big impact, but we've seen the player, the likes of Kendall Johnson, as you mentioned, Keelan Winters, Carmelina Moscato, you know, like myself, the wrong side of 30, and I'm sure she won't mind me saying that, but some experienced heads coming in as well to maybe help educate those young players.
Yeah, and like a lot of those players say, and Jess Fishlock said it herself, it's a different experience. So I think what the players have to do is come in with an open mind and say, look, it isn't going to be the same level of professionalism as the NWSL. That's what we're working towards. And those players, and Jess said it really, really well, those players come in and they've got to understand that that's the role that they're playing. They're playing a development role themselves, and it really does help in that regard. And we've seen those players come in and do that. You've seen the Keelan Winters come in and do that. I thought Carmelina Moscato was fantastic this year in that regard. And I really do think it was a big deal for those players to see that kind of player and level of professionalism that you need to be able to be there at the best stage. And I think the best quote that I got, again, in terms of Jess Fishlock, I think the best quote that she put out there in relation to that is that I feel like with Australia that the job of the international is to come in and you have to take the standards higher. It's not just the standards on the football pitch, but a football and the mentality that has to change. We understand that and we've accepted that, and we definitely saw that this season.
Yeah, well, I've spoken to both Jess and Carl Moscato since the season finished. I know they both very much enjoyed their W League season, despite the fact that they probably had differing fortunes. I mean, looking forward, last question from me. W League season is finished, but very much not the case for Australian football. We have qualifiers coming up for the Rio Olympics. My final question is, how confident are you that Australia can number one qualify? And if they do so, how much of an impact they can have down in Brazil?
I don't think this is overstating it to say that this is Australia's biggest qualifying campaign for a tournament in probably 10 years or so. I mean, in Asia, with the increase to 5 teams, Australia pretty much is a lock when it comes to World Cup positions. I mean, they haven't struggled through Asia in a long time to qualify. When it comes to the Olympics, though, with only 2 spots available, and that competitiveness of those 5 teams in the top 20, it's just going to be immense. And that first game, Australia v Japan, it's going to be an absolute blockbuster, because if Australia can get a point or even 3 points out of that, that will hold them in very good stead, because Japan gets better through a tournament and there are not many teams that are going to get points off Japan. So that's going to be big. And then Australia's next game is against Vietnam. And again, they will then look to get those 3 points. And if they can be on 4 points or even 6 points coming to that third game, it will be massive. In terms of the impact, I can't even tell you how big it would be. To be an Olympic sport, which it hasn't been since 2004, opens up all sorts of government funding, which women's football program hasn't been privy to in the last couple of years. I think it almost doubles the women's football budget for this year. So everybody understands just what a massive deal it would be for Australia to qualify for the Olympics, in particular when you consider that the Olleroos, the men's team, didn't. So that could open up that potential funding as well. So 29 February to 9 March, it's going to be a big time in Australian women's football.
Well, we look forward to it. And taking my professional hat off, I absolutely love that Australian team. I desperately hope that they are represented at the Rio Olympics. And always a pleasure for anyone that wants to keep track of how Australia are doing in their Olympic qualifying. Cannot recommend enough that you follow at the Women's Game on Twitter and thewomensgame.com for updates and lots of news and lots of views. Great team covering the game down in Australia across the whole country. And thanks for joining me. Thanks for giving us an overview of the W League. And we hope that we are speaking in the future about a successful Australian qualification campaign.
Thanks very much, Kieran, and love the job that you continue to do.
Women's Soccer Zone. It's all about the players.
So that was Anne O'Dong talking about the W League and, of course, the W League final that Melbourne City women came out victorious in. Of course, wish the Matildas well for their upcoming Olympic qualification. Very, very tough in that Asian confederation with teams like Japan, South Korea and China joining them. Next segment of the show, we have Jen Gordon from Equaliser Soccer talking to us a little bit about the dispute that's taking place between US soccer and the US Women's National Team Union. Very, very high profile news piece at the moment. Lots of unanswered questions. And I spoke to Jen to get a little bit more insight. Didn't go into too much detail because there's a lot of legal jargon that I'm sure would fly certainly over my head. So I didn't want to go into too much detail. But here's Jen talking about the dispute and a little bit about the Canadian allocations that were announced in the last few days, talking about who the winners and losers are in terms of clubs and the players that they were allocated. Okay, so for this part of the show, I'm delighted to be joined by someone I can now call a colleague from Equaliser Soccer, Jen Gordon. Jen, last time I saw you was out in Baltimore for the NWSL draft. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Very well. Thank you for joining me. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about what's going on in North America. The big story that is doing the rounds in the States at the moment is the dispute that exists between US soccer and the US Women's National Teams Union over their CBA, which stands for Collective Bargaining Agreement. Now, Jen, for those maybe over here in England who don't know as much about that, not just in England, but in Europe and maybe some other countries, what's the importance of a CBA and what's the issue that exists between US soccer and the US Women's National Team Union at the moment?
A collective bargaining agreement is basically where a labor force, in this case it would be the players' union, and an employer, the federation in this case, get together and kind of carve out what rights and sometimes obligations that the workforce will have for a specific amount of time. And it sort of just is the lays everything out on the table so it's out in the open.
Okay. So what's the issue that currently exists between US soccer and the US Women's National Team? Because it's got a little bit messy, hasn't it?
Yes. At its core level, the issue is whether or not there's a binding agreement between the players' union and the federation. The federation says there is. The players' union says there isn't. And at the end of the day, what this is really about, it can be boiled down to one word. It's about leverage. If there isn't an agreement and the players are able to strike, they have the leverage because you have the She Believes tournament coming up. You have, everything that leads up into the Olympics themselves. And then, I don't want to put the horse before the cart, as they'd say, but I don't think it's crazy to think that the team that's the reigning Olympic champions and the reigning World Cup champions would medal and then be entitled to some sort of a victory tour post Rio. It'd look horrible if it came to the point that the U.S. national team was striking at any point really leading up to the Olympics, and that's a situation that the Federation doesn't want. So if the Federation wins and the team can't strike until after the end of this year and into next year, well, then the Federation has the power in that case, because there really, if you look at the calendar, there really isn't anything much in next year. So there isn't going to be this sort of need to come to an agreement quick. The team has said that they're, or the attorney has said, we never said we're striking, we want to reserve the rights. But if you read between the lines here, it's basically comes down to whether or not they can threaten to strike and, who has the power.
So how has it got to this? What is it that the players and the union are asking of US soccer that they don't seem to be able to agree on?
I mean, if you look back, the relationship has definitely eroded for quite some time. I think from the fact that there really has, never even came to an actual collective bargaining agreement. And they've been kind of working on this memo of understanding for, going on 3 years now. And then you just look at last fall with the Hawaii game having to be canceled, then playing on turf. The team is, you're just sick of, what they see as second-class treatment in comparison to the men's team, that they clearly have been more successful. And we don't need to get into, the semantics of why the women's team is more successful than the men's team. But, it is what it is. And, they feel that they should be treated more fairly and be entitled to more benefits.
Well, we saw last year, didn't we, the impact that a dispute can have when the Australian Matildas decided not to travel to the US last year because they themselves were having issues with their federation over their CBA. What's the impact potentially on the NWSL as well? Because we could see, if players do decide to strike, it wouldn't just be for the US women's national team. It could be that it crosses over into the league. That could be quite damaging. We don't want to worry people, but there is a real risk or potential that players decide not to participate in the league as well, isn't there?
I haven't heard a lot of people bring this up, but actually in 2011, the U.S. national team players did not go into camp right away, preseason camp right away. I specifically remember, actually, this is how I remember this. Robin Gale for the Washington Spirit had actually baked Lori Lindsay a cake for her birthday, which was the 19th, the day that March 19th, the day the agreement came out. And Lori didn't get to eat it because she wasn't there. So it kind of has happened. It was only for like a week, but it's definitely a real possibility. And it's one that the Federation brought forth in their response to the players union's response to the Federation's initial filing, if that makes any sense. So we're at the third volley, basically, and the Federation saying, hey, this could have an impact on, this league. And I think that NWSL can survive a strike by the U.S. national team players. It basically comes down to what effect it would have on the attendance. I think the real issue may be long term, because they're going to lose any sort of bump and interest that they had from the World Cup, which is, I think, is something that nobody really wants to see happen. It comes down to whether or not basically NWSL is going to be collateral damage in all of this.
I mean, what needs to happen, do you think, in your mind, for this to be resolved and for this to go away, essentially?
Negotiations and good faith towards a new CBA, I think, may be enough to, I don't want to use the word placate, but maybe get the national team to not strike right away. They have said they don't want to strike, or they're not threatening to strike, but seems to be, they want to know whether or not they can strike. So, you got to ask yourself why would you really want to know if you can or not, unless you're going to threaten to use that weapon. So, I think the Federation could make some concessions in the short term too, to try to make sure that it doesn't turn into that sort of a situation. But if you look at what's happened and recently in the last couple of months between the Federation and the national team, it doesn't look good. I mean, by the Federation leaking all that personal information, that's definitely is going to cause some bad blood on top of everything. If you look at the filing by the Players Association, you know, they use the term in their filing, you know, that the Federation's initial, you know, claim has, you know, blatant inaccuracies and misrepresentations and misleadingly incomplete quotations. You know, clearly there's, I don't want to use the term bad blood again, but there's clearly some issues that definitely need to be addressed, and this is definitely something that's deteriorating. But I mean, it's definitely also a situation that could be resolved and there not be a strike. It's interesting to see how it will play out.
Well, we hope it doesn't come to that, don't we? We've seen a number of issues exist in US soccer over the years with the collapse of various domestic leagues, and you know, that threat of striking, not necessarily a big thing, but we obviously saw the players refuse to almost participate in the game in Hawaii towards the end of last year, which resulted in the game having to be postponed. But we hope it can be resolved, because nobody wants to see this happening, and I'm sure it's not doing anyone any favours, whether that be for US soccer or for the US women's national team players. We'll move on, Jen. In the last 24 hours on the evening that we're recording, or the afternoon where you are, the Canadian Soccer Association announced its allocations for the upcoming NWSL. 11 players will be allocated to the league. A few familiar faces, a few new faces. For me, the biggest name to enter the league is probably, or should I say re-enter the league, is Desiree Scott returning to FC Kansas City. Obviously, who spent the last 2 years with Notts County Ladies over here in England. That's a good move for FC Kansas City and adds a little bit of steel in that midfield.
Absolutely. And you've got FC Kansas City has lost so much in the off season for a variety of reasons. I think bringing in a player that is familiar with the coaching staff and they know what they're, you know, what she's going to bring is a definite plus, you know, especially defensively, since, you know, if you can't score a lot, and I think they are going to have issues scoring just based on what they've lost. If you can keep the other team from scoring, that's definitely going to, you know, help your chances of winning, obviously. So I think it's a huge pickup for them, and it's a good morale boost too, I think, just based on everything that's happened with them in the off season.
What were the ones that stood out for you? I liked Jessie Boulanger going to Orlando Pride, having just played in Sweden for FC Rosengard. That was another one that stood out for me. What were the moves that you liked?
I honestly, the spirit come out of this with three players, and obviously one of them, Leib, they got in a trade with Kansas City, or not with Kansas City, with Red Stars. But you know, they have the most three of the 11, and with having Reynolds end up in Portland, they're obviously down on defenders now. So it was good to get Zorski as well. So it's they're probably the big winners, and obviously Matheson has, you know, last year's was a little bit down coming off the injuries as far as production, as far as goals and assists is concerned, but she's still a very key ingredient in that team. So I think that the spirit probably gained the most, although we already know what they were getting. I think the other interesting piece, and I did talk about this on Twitter a little bit, was Janine Becky. She, you know, being allocated, you know, post draft kind of sets things up interestingly for the preceding draft, if, you know, the league sticks around, obviously, because you've got a number of Canadians that would be seniors next year and eligible for the draft if they so choose to enter. And now you've kind of set the expectation that they will just go into, you know, the draft pool, and then whoever selects them will get their allocation if they are in fact allocated. You know, obviously Kadisha Buchanan and Ashley Lawrence from West Virginia being two, and then also Rebecca Quinn from Duke. I think those three players would definitely be in the conversation to be allocated if, you know, things continue as is right now.
Yeah, of course, Janine Becky was picked up in the draft by the Houston Dash. You mentioned Washington Spirit with Selena Zdorsky and Diana Matheson. They were joined by Stephanie Labbé, the goalkeeper, who will be a more than able deputy for Ashlyn Harris, who's moved on to the Orlando Pride. There were a few clubs, though, that didn't actually get any players allocated. I think of the 10 NWSL clubs, I think four of them, off the top of my head, it was Sky Blue FC, Seattle Reign, Boston Breakers, I think Chicago Red Stars may well have been the other. We have no idea why those four clubs were not allocated players. Can we speculate that it could come down to potentially international roster spots, or maybe they just didn't want any, or there were not enough available to go around?
I mean, the Canadians shouldn't count against international, the number of international spots the team has. I think, you know, it may come down, maybe it came down to, you know, what teams wanted and what teams needed. I mean, because we've seen before, especially when Mexico was involved too, these players would get sent somewhere and they weren't good fits. And then nobody really wins in that situation because you got a player that's taking up a roster spot who isn't playing and, you know, maybe could be used better elsewhere. So I think that may be a part of it.
Okay. Well, certainly the Canadians will no doubt have an important role to play in their respective teams when they enter the NWSL, but we're not sure when that will be because, moving on, Olympic qualifying begins probably the day that this episode will come out, and of course it's in the United States. It's going to be in Frisco and in Houston. It's going to be interesting. Many will expect the United States to prevail, but as someone who's never really followed the CONCACAF qualifying, Jen, how does it work for anyone that doesn't know? How many teams will go through? How long does the competition run for, and what do you expect to happen?
You know, you have sort of the group stage where the teams will play each other, and then out of that, the top two teams in each group will go through. And basically, to qualify, you want to win your semifinal game. And then the winners of the semifinal game will play each other, which, you know, it's nice to win, but the key objective is to make sure you qualify, and you do that by winning the semifinal game, which I believe, I want to say this 19th of February is when that's going to take place.
And are we expecting it to be a comfortable US qualification alongside Canada?
You know, that I think that would be anybody's. If you're a betting person, that would be your bet. I think it'll be interesting to see what Costa Rica can do. If anything, they kind of shocked everybody in the qualifiers last time around. So, you know, it'd be good for them to, you know, have a good performance and get through to the knockout part of this qualifying tournament. And, you know, maybe they can make some noise, you know. We've all seen sometimes how, you know, it's just one play can make a difference in who wins and who doesn't in a soccer game. So, you know, they would be probably my third pick, they'd be my team that maybe could sneak in over another team, but I you know, doubt that. And then, you know, Mexico's kind of been a mess since, you know, it probably even before the World Cup last year. So I'd put them fourth. And then after that, it definitely drops down at a very steep rate.
Which players do you think are going to be the standout? We know that teams are starting to go down different roads in terms of bringing young players in. The US Women's National Team has seen some retirements. The Canadian team has left out some experienced heads that we've seen over the last few years. We'll see the likes of probably Mal Pugh and Sam Mewis and Janine Becky. Who are the players that you're looking forward to seeing during the qualification? Raquel Rodriguez, another one for Costa Rica. But which ones stand out for you?
Well, you pretty much took all the players I was going to say. I think that it's going to be interesting to see what, you know, after, you know, there is a point in the group stage where you know whether, you know, most of the time you know whether or not you're going to advance, or you know, you may feel comfortable enough to try a different lineup. So this could be a spot for some of those players that towards the end of the 20 player roster to kind of make their case for making the Olympic roster later. I think Lindsey Horan is obviously another player to watch, and she has been very pivotal in that midfield for the United States, entering the post Lauren Holiday era, if you will. So I think she's one to watch as well. And I think just with everything that's going on with the U.S. forward core right now, that's definitely something to watch. So, you know, Alex coming off, you know, really what's a slew of injuries, seeing if she can really get back into form and maybe find that groove she had in 2012 when she really led the team in the Olympics. So it'll be interesting, I think, you know, obviously Alex is an established player, but to see what happens there as well.
And one established player, just to finish off, that won't be representing the U.S., in the qualifiers is Heather O'Reilly. That one came as a surprise, didn't it?
Yeah, I think if you looked, you could kind of see the writing on the wall that she was sort of at the end of the... You would think that she'd still be there, but she'd definitely be towards the end of that 20-player roster just based on the time that she's had in the, you know, the World Cup and such. But, you know, she set a new record for the beep test, so it's definitely... You know, it's not a fitness thing. So I think that's an interesting move, and one that definitely had people talking. I think what she brings to the table as far as, you know, just her ability to get up and down that flank and just constantly and then those crosses is killer. It could be something that the U.S. really misses. It'll be interesting to see, you know, what happens after this roster as far as... you know, preparation and whether or not, you know, Hayo gets called back in and what happens there. You know, sometimes getting left off a roster ends up working out for a player as far as, you know, them. I'm not saying Heather O'Reilly isn't dedicated. She obviously is. But, you know, sometimes, you know, they learn something from it and come back as a better player. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there.
Yeah, absolutely. Big fan of Heather O'Reilly, and another player that will be missing is Sydney LaRue, who announced that she is due to have her first child with her husband, Dom Dwyer. So we wish them well, but not going to take up any more of your time, Jen. Perhaps you can come back and speak to me after the qualification period is done and fill me in on what's been going on. Not sure how much of it I'm going to see how much access I can get to, but really appreciate you taking some time out to join me.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, final segment of the show, and I didn't mention it in the intro because I haven't written down my running order, and because I don't have JJ by my side, I've become very waylaid. But I managed to catch up with Leah Galton, English player who was selected 13th overall by Sky Blue FC in the NWSL draft out of Hofstra University. So I wanted to have a chat with her about being drafted, what it's like to be a college player waiting to be selected by one of the 10 NWSL clubs, and for her, and to hear her hopes and aspirations in joining the New Jersey club. So here she is.
So I'm delighted to be joined by Sky Blue FC's newest recruit, Leah Galton, who was selected 13th overall in the NWSL college draft recently. Leah, thank you very much for joining me.
No problem.
So I guess the first question I'd have is, how pleasing, how delighted are you to begin your professional career as a soccer player in New Jersey with Sky Blue FC?
It's basically been a dream the past couple of weeks. It still doesn't feel real yet because obviously I haven't had chance to go and meet everyone, so until that happens, it still is one of my dream from when I was 4, 5, 6 growing up. I always said I wanted to play professionally, and now it's come true. It doesn't seem real yet, but I'm super excited to be going and joining Sky Blue. I've heard a lot of good things. Obviously they have a new manager and he seems tremendous at what he does, so I'm very excited to go and start down there with the girls.
No, I was in Baltimore for the draft. There were a number of players who attended. One of your former teammates, Rachel Daly at Leeds Ladies, who we'll talk about a little bit later, who was obviously picked as well in the first round. What's it like for a player like yourself who's not at the draft? How does it work when you're waiting to be selected? Are you waiting by a phone? Do you have any indication as to who's going to pick you? What's going through your mind and what's happening to you while that draft is going on?
To be honest, I didn't really know how the drafting system worked because obviously I'd been from a different country and wasn't too sure. But I landed the day before the draft pretty late at night, so I didn't get a chance to go down to Baltimore, which I wish I could have done, but I didn't. But it was streamed live on a website, so I got everyone around that was around at Hofstra, because obviously we don't go back to school until Monday, so not many people are around. But I came back early to obviously watch the draft and to start my training and start practicing so I can be ready for when I go. I got friends around and we sat around the TV and we linked up to a big TV and watched it. And to be honest, I couldn't believe it when he said my name and where I was going, and I was super, super happy, and everyone was very happy for me. So
you hadn't had any dialogue with Sky Blue at this point? They hadn't spoken to you? You had no idea that they were going to select you?
I mean, I had spoken with a few teams in the league, but no one obviously is going to say, right, I'm definitely going to choose you. And you never know with the picks and the different swaps that they do, you never know until the day. So, I mean, I had ideas, but you don't know until you get called out, so.
And what's kind of going through your mind when you see a lot of journalists, a lot of media out in the States doing kind of mock drafts, predicting where you could potentially go in the draft and which team you may well end up in? What's your thoughts when you see things like that?
It makes me just super excited, really. I am delighted that it's so close to Hofstra, so it's not far to come back and see people, because obviously I've made a lot of good friends and a lot of close relationships here. I've got a lot of thanking to do to the people at Hofstra, so my team and my coaches who have got me to where I am today. It's going to be nice being close to where I've been the past 4 years. Can't wait to meet the new team, start practicing with everyone. Obviously, we have preseason. Can't wait to start working with the new coach. He seems like a great guy. And it's just going to be great.
And a new coach, as you say, and players that people will recognise, the likes of very experienced players, top internationals, Christy Rampone, Kelly O'Hara, Australians such as Samantha Kerr, Caitlin Ford. How excited are you to be linking up with players of that sort of calibre?
I honestly don't believe it yet. Until I get on the field and start playing with them, it doesn't feel like it's going to happen. And I guess I need to start realising it is going to happen. It's going to be the best feeling in the world. Obviously, I've gone through 4 years of college, and it's been a challenge. College games are not easy, but I don't think there's going to be a challenge quite like what I'm heading for. So I'm really excited to get going with that, because I love a good challenge, and I'm super excited to improve as a player, because I'm definitely going to improve more. The more I play with good players, the more I'm going to improve. So I'm excited for that.
Well, we'll talk about your career at Hofstra, because you did break some records while you were there. But I guess one of the questions I'd have, when you're waiting to be selected, we've talked about what you were doing during the draft. How much more nerve-wracking is it when you're an international player? We know that squads have a limited number of roster spots for internationals. There are some top, top class players from all over the world that are playing in the NWSL. We see them week in, week out, representing what will now be 10 clubs in the league. When you're an international player, you know that a club is going to have to take not only a bit of a chance on you because you're a college player, but also they're going to have to put a lot of faith in you because you are filling one of their international spots. Does that make it more difficult when you're waiting to see where you're going to be going?
It definitely does, yeah. Obviously, when I've spoken with a few of the coaches, they have to tell it's a big risk they're going to take because I'm international, and for me it's a lot harder, obviously, than someone who lives here. So I agree they're taking a big risk, but I'm hoping that risk is going to pay off and it's going to be worth it, because I'm not going to give anything less than my best. So I'm hoping that's good enough.
We mentioned Hofstra University. 48 goals during your time there, 26 assists. Now, you acquired 122 points. Now, for anyone that doesn't know, the 122 points are essentially made up of points gained by the goals and the assists that Leah has gained. That is a college record for Hofstra University. That shows the sort of form that you were in for your college. How difficult, you've already said that it's very challenging in the college system, but how difficult was it and how different was it to your time back in here in England when you were playing for Leeds United?
Completely different. I always say this to people when they ask me how soccer is different over here, and obviously, first of all, it's called soccer and not football, but the way they play here in college is a lot more, I want to say it's a lot more physical, like it's a physical challenge more than anything. If you're quicker than someone, if you're stronger than someone, it's a lot easier to be good in the game if you're physically more adapted. Back home, it's more of a technique, who's better at playing. Here it's more, a lot more physical.
So how much did you have to adapt your game when you moved out to Hofstra a few years ago, having come from a game that was more technical into one that was more physical?
I did have to change it quite a lot. I was still a pretty physical player back at Leeds. I was obviously a winger, and you obviously have to be quick and strong and skillful. That worked for me out here. My speed was one of my assets, and that still is, and I'm very happy with that, and I will continue to work on that. But it did take a while to change, especially in my head, like knowing that a lot of play is going to come down to me because of the advantages we have on my side. But it was worth the change, and I've really enjoyed the past 4 years out here.
What are the sort of things that you've tried to keep from your game back at home to try and make you maybe have a little bit of an upper hand over some of your American colleagues who haven't played abroad?
Definitely my game in my head. How I read the game and how I read situations is a big asset out here. I know for a fact that obviously we have other internationals on the team, and you can see that when we're playing. It's not just physically we're getting to the same level as the Americans, but technically and reading the game, we're a lot better. So obviously not a lot better than everyone, but majority of people were a lot better at doing that. And I think that's a good thing that internationals bring over here. So we have intelligence on the field, and as well as Americans who bring the physical part.
Well, I've already mentioned the records that you broke at the university. I think the 48 goals that you scored was second all time. You also made the NSCAA second team, All-American second team in 2015. You were joined in that team by the likes of Janine Becky, who was obviously drafted by the Houston Dash. Who else was in there? Mackenzie Doniek, who went to Western New York Flash. Erica Skorsky, who will be with you in Sky Blue. How much of an honour was it to be named in such a prestigious team, you know, the second team of, you know, an All-American side?
I was delighted. I honestly didn't think I would make an All-American, but it was one of the things I always wanted to do, and I always was hoping that would happen, and when I got told, when it got announced that I made the team, I was more than delighted. It's such an honour to be a part of a team like that, and when you look at the people in that team, and I look at how great these people are too, these players are, it makes me realise that I must be good in some shape or form.
We got a lot to look forward to. Now, I read an interview with you when you were a 17-year-old at Leeds United, and I was interested in some of the answers that you gave. One of the questions that She Kicks magazine asked you, which is the interview I've taken from, they asked you what you like to eat after a match on a Sunday. Now, you said a roast dinner and Cadbury's milk chocolate buttons. Now, I know, and you know, being English, that the chocolate in the US is nowhere near as good as it is over here in England, and roast dinners don't tend to be a Sunday tradition. So what are you eating after games now then, Leah?
I wish it was roast dinners and chocolate buttons still. But it's changed a lot, obviously. After games over here at college, we generally have like a tailgate where the parents make food and bring it for all the players, and they do look after like us a lot, and they cook some really good food. So we have lots of different things, but very, very Americanized. We have like pastas. We have to recarb ourselves and be ready for the next game.
And one of the other questions was, which player would you like to play with in a team, male or female? Now, you gave the answer of Gareth Bale. Would you still give that answer of Gareth Bale, or do you think the women's game has come far enough now where young players have female role models that they might want to play in the same team as?
I I think that I still would obviously love to play with him. I think he's a great, great soccer player. But I agree. I think the female game has come further enough now for me to say that I would love to play with the majority of the national team players. I would love to have a chance to play on the same field as them. The likes of Alex Morgan and people like that, I would love to play with them or against them. But it's definitely come on a lot further, and I agree. I think it's still coming on, and I'm excited to see where it goes.
And I guess my final question, because I don't want to keep you for too long, being an English player, I'm sure you will have seen the success of the England Lionesses in 2015. Is that something that you think about? I know it's very early on, and I'm not going to put any pressure on you because you've still got a long career ahead of you, but I spoke to Rachel Daly at the draft. She said that the England team was something that she would love to be a part of. How much of an incentive is it for you to do well at Sky Blue so that you might get that much-desired call-up?
It's a huge incentive. Obviously, playing for your national team is the top of the top, and I would love to be back there. I played there when I was under-15s, under-17s, under-19s, and I enjoyed it, and the experience you get from it is nothing like anything else. It's amazing, and to play for your country obviously is such a privilege, and it makes you so proud. I would love to be back in the setup, and I'm hoping that the hard work I'm going to put in and have put in is going to help me get there.
And how much of an honour would it be for you to line up in that England team alongside Rachel Daly, both from Harrogate, both know each other from your days at Leeds United, both drafted in the same draft class in the NWSL? That would be special, wouldn't it?
It would be. I think that would be a highlight of my career, definitely. I'm so happy for Rach. I've obviously known her for a while, and she came out to America. We both came out at similar times, and I've always seen her in the news. She's doing so well. She did so well. She had a great career, obviously, St. John's. I would love to play with her. I think she's a great player. I would learn a lot from her, and I'd definitely get better from playing with her. But to line up in the national team with her would be a dream come true.
Brilliant. Well, we really do wish you the best, Leah. We obviously cover a lot of women's soccer over here at Women's Soccer Zone, and we'll be keeping tabs on your NWSL career. And let us know when you have introduced the traditional Sunday roast to your teammates.
I will do.
Women's Soccer Zone. Listen to the show on Audio Boom or download via iTunes. Just search for Women's Soccer Zone.
So big thanks to Leah Galton. Genuinely, much like Rachel Daly, wish her well in the upcoming season in the NWSL. And that brings us to the end of the show. Thank you very much, as always, for tuning in. Apologies that it's just been myself, but I hope that with the interviews that we've had and, of course, being joined by brilliant pundits like Anne O'Dong and Jen Gordon, we've had a little bit of insight into the game down in Australia and in America. If, of course, you want to contact us, you can do. We are on at WosoZone on Twitter. If you want to email us, you can do. We're on WosoZone@gmail.com. Of course, you can listen to the show via two avenues. You can download it on iTunes by just searching for Women's Soccer Zone, or, of course, on the website, audioboom.com/WosoZone. And any feedback you have, always feel free to send it over. So for another couple of weeks, I wish you well, and we will speak to you all very soon.